Hey, everybody. Happy Friday. This is Trevin McGee again with the Scene Stealers podcast, and we're a man down this week. Mr. Trey Hawk decided he would rather go boating.
He's a loser. He's in the Bahamas or Timbuktu or...
Yeah, he's somewhere where he can post pictures of how much fun he's having.
Argentina.
Yeah, so Trey, if you get to hear this, we're thinking of you in both a sexual and non-sexual way this
morning.
And
it's freaking cold here, so screw you.
So this is, again, Trevin, and I'm here with Eric Moline, my partner in crime. And we're going to talk about some movies this week. We've got Amour.
Yes.
Identity Thief.
Uh-huh.
Warm Bodies.
Yeah.
And Side Effects.
Yes. And the new Steven Soderbergh movie.
The last theatrically released. Yes. Yeah. So now it's just Liberace and HBO for this guy and painting from now on. So we'll get to that in a second, though. First, we're going to talk about Amour.
Best Picture nominee.
Just a real, just slapstick, lightweight. A lot of pratfalls in this movie. Eric, go ahead and set this one up since I can't talk about it with a straight face.
Well, Amour really benefited this year in the Oscar nominations from the Oscars having what they call a preferential ballot. And of course, I can't pronounce it. Preferential ballot, which means that... basically, the people who were really, really excited about Amour were able to give it a higher ranking on their list for choosing Best Picture. And that's also why Michael Haneke, the director, got a nomination as well as a writing nomination. And Emmanuelle Riva was nominated as well for Best Actress. This is a foreign film. It takes place almost entirely in a French apartment. With an old couple played by Emmanuelle Riva and Jean-Louis Trintignant, who are both extraordinary actors and have been on the scene for a very long time. Him since Bertolucci's The Conformist, mm-hmm. Her since Hiroshima Mon Amour, and they're both in their 80s now. And this is extraordinary personal and subtle work from both of them. And I think that a lot of the talk of this film will be focused on the two actors. They play a married couple, and they are, as the title would suggest, in love still after all this time, and they have this great deep respect for each other. And that is shown right away in the beginning of the film in such a simple fashion as they're coming home from a concert, and they're just talking to each other about a break-in, about a possible break-in that somebody might have been able to get into their house and what that would do to them. And this film is very sparse and formal, meaning that the camera hardly moves at all and essentially explores the relationship between this old couple. What happens is that Emmanuelle Riva's character temporarily loses her place, and it's discovered later that she's had a stroke, and their lives are forever changed by this. Now, all of this stuff sounds like a movie that I would not rush out to see. In fact, I had this screener for 3 to 4 weeks. Even with the buzz that it got at the Cannes Film Festival last year, let it sit on my shelf for that long before I actually watched it. But
It won the Palme d'Or.
Yeah. And Michael Haneke is a filmmaker who previously did The White Ribbon. Before that, he did a thriller called Caché. And he's done a very provocative, interesting movie called Funny Games that a lot of people hated, and then remade it in America with Naomi Watts and Michael Pitt. Mm-hmm. And Haneke has this reputation for being a guy who's always pushing buttons. And this movie is one of those films where you feel like at first that perhaps he has changed his ways and he's not pushing the buttons so much as he's letting his characters breathe. And I think that's mainly due to the warmth of the performances from his two main actors. But when I was on the critics panel, Marie Asner criticized this film and said that it was too sentimental. And to me, she's a fellow critic in the film circle. That, for me, is just 100% wrong. I thought that this movie was an unsparing, if not downright cynical, look at what happens at the end of your life,
yeah,
nearing death. And it's only because of the great actors in the film that we are able to get any warmth out of this film at all. But mostly what I got was a sense of chaos and these lives being changed forever, followed by mercy, which we don't usually get in Haneke's film, in his movies. Yeah. I don't know.
Unless it comes at the end of a golf club.
Yeah, exactly. And this is rightly being passionately talked about this year, and I can't say enough good things about it. It was number one on my best films of the year. You were talking earlier, and you said it's the only Best Picture nominee you haven't seen twice.
Yeah.
And I totally understand that. I've only seen it once as well. I had such a visceral reaction to it. But then also, I think when movies do that, I tend to not be able to see their formal brilliance. And in this film, there's plenty of time because it is kind of a slow-moving, meditative movie. There's plenty of time to realize how brilliantly it's written, directed, put together, acted, and everything while it's happening, as well as giving you a couple really visceral moments. And I just think it's an extraordinary piece of work, and any true cinema fan has to see it. I don't want to alienate anybody by talking it up like this great, you know, arty masterwork. I think it's still approachable from people who aren't willing to delve deeper into how it was made and the structure and things like that. But yeah, I don't know. I just can't say enough good things about this movie. It's such a well-rounded film.
Yeah, you know, I really... It is a difficult film for me to watch more than once, just because of the themes and what it deals with. You know, you already touched on it, but an elderly couple at the end of their lives, what that means, you know, when things change, this person that you've known for your, you know, entire adult life, where do you go from there? What happens when something changes them? I mean, those are themes, and those are things that are kind of difficult, especially, you know, everyone can kind of relate to them, especially, I mean, I guess the older you get, the easier it is to relate to that, because everyone's had a grandparent or a parent that they've had to see that happen to or deal with, and it treats that really even-handedly. Not romantically, and definitely not sentimentally.
Yeah.
You know? There are some, you know, one of the things that I really, you know, it sounds weird to say I liked, was that usually when that happens in movies, usually when an older character, like I'm thinking of like the Ted Danson movie Dad, you know, but usually in movies like that where somebody's getting older, it's kind of treated as like, oh, well, Dad's getting older and it's okay.
There's a serious health decline,
but you know, he's still the, you know, he's not a burden at all. And this, you know, I kind of like that the one of the daughter's big issues is that she's like, how am I going to take care of these two people when I've got an entire life to deal with?
Well, here's another interesting thing. I was listening to the Film Spotting podcast, and they talked about this movie, a great podcast if anybody there is listening and hasn't checked it out. And one of them brought up the fact that as younger people, when Isabelle Huppert, who plays the daughter, the couple's daughter, comes into the picture, we may be able to identify in a normal movie, we would be able to identify with her problem, but because we've spent so much time with this couple and we've seen how in love they are and how personal this is to them and how much they want to deal with it in their own way,
right,
we have a completely different perspective when she comes in the picture and brings that up. In a normal movie, you might be like, oh, yeah, you know, this is a problem for everybody. Mm-hmm. But in this movie, you're like, fuck her daughter.
Stay out of this.
This is tough, and they're going to deal with it. And it sucks because even after 80 years or how many years? Let's say they've been together for 60.
Yeah.
We can assume that. 60-ish years, 50-ish years. They deserve to be able to handle this the way they want.
Right,
they still feel
that.
Like they haven't had all the time together they want. And there's a scene in the film where they surprise each other and there's still things that they don't know about each other. And that's such a romantic, notion,
yeah.
but it is not portrayed in a romantic way. That's what I'm saying, is it's not a sentimental film, but there's a ton of emotion brought into it.
Yeah.
And the way that Haneke does this with the screenplay, it's just extraordinary to get those feelings out without using them in a manipulative, sentimental way. And honestly, I'm going to say this now. This is going to be the surprise winner for original screenplay this year.
You think so?
It will win. That's my prediction.
I would be completely fine with
that's
that.
That's where I mean, the passion for this movie, I think, is going to trump everything else.
Yeah. I would love that. I wouldn't be upset if that happened at all.
And that's also because Mark Bowles kind of getting screwed. Zero Dark Thirty seems to have lost
Zero
all
Dark
its Thirty
is just
luster.
Getting hosed.
Yeah.
Which, you know, that the minute I like a, you know, the minute I'm like, this is my favorite movie, it gets, someone wraps dynamite around it and blows it up.
I think that would normally be the front runner, but anyway.
Well, that's great. So, I mean, it goes without saying, but we both gave this movie Rock Fist way up.
Yeah, it's the reason we're reviewing it now is because it opens in Kansas City this weekend. Finally, it's been slowly expanding across the country. I think actually its wide expansion is this week. So if you're in a city where Amor is showing, seek this film out. See it this weekend.
It has one of my favorite moments of last year in film, too, when they're at the table. And it's just it's a great –
yeah,
that's a great moment. That's
There's so many.
Yeah.
There's so many great moments. But, yeah.
They say a lot. Just in a look and a response, and that's a great scene.
And you know what? If the best actor field wasn't so crowded already, I would normally say that Jean-Louis Trintignant would also be nominated here. But as is the case, the one who gets sick is usually the one that gets the most attention.
I'm not
taking anything away from Reva's performance. It was absolutely amazing.
But you're right. I'd love.
I think she has a good chance of being a spoiler as well.
Yeah.
To beat Jennifer Lawrence in Best Actress.
Yeah. It is interesting to see how the Oscars panned out because they had to vote or nominate before, you know,
before the Guild Awards.
Before the Guild Awards. So now everything's kind of topsy turvy. Ben Affleck just won Director's Guild.
Yes, he did.
So Argo's going. He's getting. You know, he can't win. The good news is Eric. He can't win.
That is
at the
good
Oscars.
News. Yes.
So it's got to be someone else.
Yep.
All right, well, let's move on then. Let's talk about another esteemed director.
Auteur.
Even though he rarely writes his own movies anymore. Steven Soderbergh, who has, you know, recently said that he's been saying this for a while, but it looks like he's actually going to go through with it. That he's going to retire from making feature films and focus on his painting and work in television. So with that in mind, it's a very realistic possibility that his new movie Side Effects will be his last feature length
theatrical release.
And he's got his Liberace biopic that he's been working on for a while is gonna, I think HBO picked it up, so it's finally found a home. Everybody passed on it, which you would think, you know, Matt Damon, Michael Douglas, Steven Soderbergh, you'd think that would be. You know, somebody would want that. You'd think Village Roadshow or somebody would pick that up. But regardless, it's going to show up on HBO. I'm not sure when. I don't think they've named a release date. Listen, Side Effects, I'm a bit disappointed that this could be his last theatrical film. It's a very... I think it speaks really highly of his talent that the film works at all. Mm. It changes gears... about three times, it becomes three different movies. You know, it starts out as what you would consider kind of like a social problem film, kind of like Traffic. It looks like it's going to really dive into a lot of the pharmaceutical industry and how that's just how big pharma is so prevalent, you know. And then it becomes kind of a mystery, and then it becomes kind of a revenge film by the end. Performance or actors, we got Rooney Mara. In one of her first movies, post Dragon Tattoo, we've got Channing Tatum briefly, Catherine Zeta-Jones, Jude Law, and that's really the extent of it. It's a very small cast. You recognize a few of the outside supporting characters, but it's pretty much a four-person cast. The short version of the plot is that Rooney Mara's character is very depressed. And her husband, Channing Tatum's recently been released from prison for insider trading. He went to jail for some insider trading. And she's just trying to get a handle on her depression. She goes to see a psychiatrist after a suicide attempt. and that psychiatrist is Jude Law. And then things kind of go sideways from there. It starts out as just sort of a simple look at this woman who's depressed and becomes kind of the threefold movie I just described.
Well, it gets more complicated because Jude Law prescribes a drug for her that we find out later is something that he is basically being paid to distribute and to do a test on, a research test. And we learn, you know, as the mechanics of the plot develop, we learn that these doctors are paid to do these things, these this research with these new drugs, and paid to peddle them to their patients. And mm-hmm. we start to believe that, you know, maybe he's doing this for the wrong reasons, and right. and maybe you know that he shouldn't have been co-opted like this, and maybe thought twice before. Before giving her this drug. And then, of course, Zeta Jones plays Rooney Mara's former doctor.
Yeah.
And he goes to visit her and learns some things about her past. But, yeah, the movie does take a turn, and it turns into a very interesting psychological thriller for part of it. And then towards the end, and, of course, we don't want to give this away, it just – it's one of those thrillers where the twists seem – like they are character-driven for a while.
Right.
And then they seem like they are desperately plot-driven.
Right.
And I think, like you said, in Soderbergh's hands, at the beginning of this film, there's such great drama and such Rooney Mara, I mean, this is quite a performance.
She's just going to be one of those actresses that we always say, what a performance from. Like yeah. at this point, I think it's fair to say that she's just going to be one of those that we're always blown away by.
It's three in a row, certainly, yeah. from her.
She's phenomenal. And, you know, Channing Tatum isn't bad. I think he gets a bad rap for being kind of a meathead action guy. But, you know, he's been in three Soderbergh movies now. And,
yeah.
he's solid in all of them.
He doesn't have that much to do in this film. But he makes his character a lot more likable than I think it would be in other hands.
Yeah.
Which is key. Because we need him to be likable.
Yeah.
But in reality, I think what this movie's about, when it switches gears and becomes less of an indictment of the pharma industry, I think it's about selfish people taking what they want. And I think that's a good basis for any thriller. I think most double-crossing...
Double Indemnity, Diabolique.
Yeah, exactly.
Great. Knife in the Water.
You know,
great thrillers and all. That's kind of the central theme to all of them.
Yeah, so I'm trying to figure out why this one rubbed me the wrong way. I think maybe it was just too many coincidences. When you learn you know, what's really going on in the plot, you have to just kind of ask yourself, does this fit with what I know of the characters before that? And I had a little hard time with that, and then I had a little hard time with a little bit of a hard time with the self-righteousness of Jude Law's character.
Yeah.
Towards the end, certainly, I would say that there are audience-pleasing moments that he has, but it just seemed like a little bit of pandering to me. I don't know. I mean, I'm really mixed on it. I think ultimately, this is still a minor rock fist up for me, because if it was shot in a normal Hollywood way, I think it would be a less interesting film.
Yeah, it wouldn't have worked.
The intimacy that Soderbergh brings to it, and the fact that these characters seem really isolated against their background. This is not a movie where we get a lot of long establishing shots. You know, this is
it opens and closes with a long.
Right, but I mean, it's
establishing.
Yeah, exactly.
It's bookended by a really isolated, alienating.
Yeah, that's a really good point. At the beginning of the film.
It's the same shot at the end of the film, just in a different place.
Yeah, and it's very 70s in that way, too.
It is, yeah. That sort of slow pan.
Yeah. Yeah. But then everything else during the movie, it's like these characters are not really interacting with their surroundings.
No. And then the other thing I really thought was interesting, you know, first of all, it's very efficient. Typical Soderbergh, very efficient. It takes its time when it needs to, but it also – he's so good at – the sort of voiceover montage and just kind of getting you from point A to point B with some images, sometimes still, sometimes moving, and then a voiceover cut over the top of it that kind of explains where she was at or what she was doing or how this happened. And that works to his benefit a couple times mm-hmm. in the movie. When Jude Law's doing kind of his detective work, I liked that it hung on long enough to point out that he was obsessing on it, but then it also was efficient enough and speedy enough that you like, we didn't have to spend 15 minutes or 20 minutes of the movie him, you know, pulling his hair out, trying to figure out if he'd been set up or not. You know, I liked how efficiently it handled that and kind of transitioned into the third act revenge bit. It's unsettling, you know, especially I've been thinking about it since I watched it. We got to see it Monday, and it is definitely unsettling to think about. I won't spoil it, but how revenge is exacted in this movie, in that it's completely legal abuse of patient doctor, you know, privilege.
I think that's another stretching of credulity for me. It's a little tough to believe some of the things that have to happen in order for him to be able to have that power.
Yeah, I mean, it's still just it plays on a common fear, though. The idea you trust your doctor,
right?
And so the idea that he, you know, and granted, you know,
both at the beginning and the end of the film, and for different reasons, it's terrifying.
Yeah, and so when it touches on things like that, when it leaves me unsettled for the right reasons, I enjoy it. But I agree there are some unnecessary twists and plotting towards the end that just kind of cloud it up. It doesn't need to happen. Frankly.
Did you see American Horror Story Asylum this year?
I didn't. I intentionally I skipped out on that.
That show is hilarious, but yeah. I couldn't help but think of it a couple times with the doctors and
tawdry.
Doctors locking up patients and this tawdry kind of.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, it's nowhere near over the top or gothic or silly or campy.
But it's a minor rock fist up for me, too. Yeah. I mean, it's entirely because of Soderbergh that it stays afloat. Rooney Mara is great. You know, Zeta-Jones doesn't have a lot to do. I like Jude Law in it, despite... He's great. He's not a likable character, but I thought that he played his part very well. And, again, you know, Channing Tatum, it's, you know, too bad he's going to just... After Soderbergh quits making movies, he's just...
You think he's
going
to be in trouble?
He's just going to be a meathead and do G.I. Joe movies for the rest of his career.
But, yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, 21 Jump Street showed that he can have a...
Yeah,
a
there's supposedly a... All right, well, we can now move on to a movie that doesn't have a good sense of humor about itself.
Oh, wow. Right away.
Right away.
He comes out swinging.
Identity Thief. Identity Thief. I saw it by myself. I wish you could have made it just so that you could share my pain with this one. Done by the same guy who directed Horrible Bosses. Stars Jason Bateman.
And...
King of Kong.
Festival,
I know.
Quarters,
I don't like
which
to
now
mention.
Seems like such a distant memory.
Yeah, and a high point.
Yeah.
Honestly, like in hindsight, I watching that like cheaply made, clearly slanted documentary.
Yeah.
I never would have thought like this is the best he's gonna do. But after seeing his two follow-ups, I'm like, this is the best he's gonna do. So, I was not happy with it. I'll get to that in a second. But we've got Jason Bateman again. Who he was in Horrible Bosses. Melissa McCarthy, who's just on fire right now in terms of she's like the supporting actress to get in comedies, even if it's just to make a quick
Oscar
you know,
nominated Melissa McCarthy.
Yeah, quick. Even if it's just to make a quick you know cameo or pop in like in This Is 40. Who I you know I thought she stole This Is 40.
You know I love how everybody talks about how Melissa McCarthy is on fire, but yet she has this show called Mike and Molly that's on TV, and I don't know anybody that watches it.
Yeah, no one does. Well, that's not true. We don't, but a lot of people do.
Really?
It's CBS. It's CBS. I'm sure anyone over like age 49 just watches the shit out of that show.
Crowd loves her in one way, and then the weird, edgy, rated R comedy crowd loves her.
Loves her in another way.
So is this weird, edgy, and rated R?
It is rated R. It's not weird. It's not edgy.
Okay.
It's also not good. The gist of the movie is that Jason Bateman's identity gets stolen by Melissa McCarthy's character. He leaves his company and gets a new job at a startup. But then right when things are going great, his credit reports show up. He defaults on all this stuff. His cards are declined. And his boss wants him to stick around but really can't justify it. Also, the police get involved. So it becomes a whole big deal. And so he finally says, hey, what if I go grab the girl or grab the person that did this to me and bring her back here and then get her to admit that she stole my identity? What if I do all of that?
And what's his name?
His name is Sandy Bigelow Patterson. And so she goes by the same name. He's got a unisex first name, and that's like a recurring joke in the movie that's never funny, where everyone's like, it's a girl's name. That's, you know, a lot of them like that. And so that's the whole gist of the movie. It's a road movie. It's like if Midnight Run weren't fun, or, you know, had likable characters in it.
So Due Date,
it's basically. Yeah, it's like Due Date. It's like Due Date. Except, you know, even that had some moments
that
I liked.
This is worse than Due Date?
I think so.
Oh, my God.
And I'm in the minority here. I mean, it got laughs. I'm sure it's going to do well. And everyone's going to say, oh, well, just critics hate everything. And you say, you know, I'm sure that I'm going to get, you know, this is an argument for critic elitism, I guess. But you want to know what the whole joke of the entire movie is?
Yes.
Melissa McCarthy's a fat person.
Right.
That's the gist. I mean, they make her do pratfalls. She, like, tries to jump and grab a chandelier and face plants and then gets up. All of the credit that she had earned from being just a talented ad-libber and that sort of go-to performance in comedies, like the cameos and things like This Is 40.
The supporting stuff.
Yeah, the great supporting stuff. All of that stuff that she had earned is just kind of thrown out. She doesn't really have a lot of opportunity to do. If it is improv, it's not very good.
So, and she can't be a lead, or is it just the
material? I think it's the material. I think it could be a combination, too. I think she's better in small doses, and I think that the material's bad. Bateman's a straight man like he always is, and he has his moments. But for a road movie, it's just not... You know, it's just not very good. It's not very good. The motivation, the kid there doesn't make any sense. There's a decision, like, if you want to break it down into a plot, there's a decision that doesn't make any sense, where he basically commits the same kind of crime that she does.
Yeah.
Which is idiotic.
Talk about it being rated R. Like, rated R is it?
Not very. It's not
pretty risque.
It's not like Horrible Bosses. It's not the hard R that like a Farrelly Brothers comedy would get.
So it doesn't make you feel like you need to take a shower when you're done?
No. You know, it's just... the joke really is... The only joke really is that she's a big girl and she falls down.
She's a great big fat
person. It's like, have you seen that episode of 30 Rock where, like, Jenna's gotten fat and so she just, like, falls down and says, me want food, and everyone... And that's, like, her best character for a while.
Yeah.
That's this movie.
Yeesh.
That's this movie. It's just her, like, she gets hit by a car and everyone laughed. Everyone just laughed and laughed when she got hit by a car. And it's graphic. Like, she gets smashed onto the windshield and thrown over the top and just belly laughs in the audience. Just guffaws.
Guffaws.
Yeah. You know... Then also it's really funny when you try and sexualize a large person.
Right.
And so she's, you know, whenever she tries to, you know, make it sexual.
It was funny.
Hilarious.
It was funny.
Everyone just, you know, so funny when she's, you know, trying to seduce Eric Stone Street. Hilarious. And then there is
shit in the sink.
No, there's no sink shitting. There's nothing scatological or gross like that about this movie at all. No, there's nothing like that.
Yeah.
It's not. It doesn't go over the top that way. If anything, it's, you know, it's just boring, and the story's just poor. Like, the construction's bad, and then any opportunity to, like, insert some thoughtful cameos or some funny humor like that. Robert Patrick's in it as, like, a hillbilly that's chasing him because she's shown up on a credit report. Or she's defaulted on some loans, and he's just out to get her and take her back. T.I. is in it, and the rapper T.I. is in it, and then Ellie Kemper is in it for, like, a scene. Yeah, and she doesn't do anything.
So let me ask you this. Is this one of those movies
John Favreau's kind of funny at the beginning as an asshole boss.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's like the fourth horrible boss that they didn't have time to put in to horrible bosses because he's a big... power trader dickhead.
So is this like a there's two kinds of comedies that I see that come out these days. There's the Apatow ilk, where you actually try to have believable characters who get into ridiculous situations, and then there's the lame SNL sketch kind of padded out to 90 minutes where
this is not that's the other thing that's insane about this movie. It's not 90 minutes, it's close to 2 hours.
What?
Yeah.
Ugh.
Started at 7:30 and it got out at almost 9:30.
But is it just one of those films where people do whatever they need to do in the scene to be funny? And
no,
really
see,
because
like Horrible Bosses, I would never say is a good comedy. Yeah. I would never say Horrible Bosses is a good comedy. But what he did in Horrible Bosses that worked was he had three talented improvisers that he just would turn loose, and he would hold scenes longer than they should have. Like the beats were off all the time because they would always top each other or try and end a scene with something funny. And it works.
And
it's,
they were
it's
funny.
Great. And, it, and they were funny, and it works because it's a great sort of like caught it on TV type movie. You catch it on HBO at 2 in the afternoon, and you get 5 or 6 laughs out of it, and then, you know, go on. When you're stuck in a theater and it's the only thing you can focus on, assuming you turn your phone off like you should, it doesn't hold up because you just get kind of beat to death with these sort of improvs that don't really go anywhere, and then you're stuck with a meatless story and nothing to really go with. This doesn't even do that. There's just not a lot that goes on. It's really boring, and I mean, I can't stress it enough. The entire joke of the movie is that she's a bigger girl and that sometimes she's like a sexual creature, and that's funny. And not like in Bridesmaids where she's, you know, over the top and doing the, you know, undercarriage and steam heat. Yeah, all this. It's this weird, like, and like Eric Stone Street's in it again, you know, and he's an overweight fella too, and so the two of them together, that's like the gist of it, is just that they're both like big people, and there is like a love scene between them or a sex scene between them, but it's so, I don't know if there's an unrated version that they're going to save, but if they're going to do that, you know, that would have been an opportunity to like, I mean, I'm not saying I wanted this, but if they're going to go for the ha-ha fat people joke, then they could have made some real points with an audience that wants to laugh at fat people if they'd shown them having sex. That would have been hilarious to show them comically having sex. But instead, they do that in the weirdest way, and people still just thought it was so funny.
Well, I mean, there is a reason that when we do press screenings for comedies that they try to fill the house and, you know.
Anyway, it was a total disappointment. There's only one thing, and I say disappointment, like, I was going in cautiously, not even
cautiously
optimistic, because I just wanted to see if she had what it took to be a lead or if she could make the material funny, you know, because Bateman's a proven straight man. I thought, you know, maybe we'd get something useful out of it, but we don't. I mean, I got to give him a rock fist way down. Like,
wow.
I felt insulted by it, frankly. And the only thing it does that is kind of unexpected or noteworthy is that there's a moment where you think Bateman's going to, like Bateman said, like, oh, I learned a lot about myself on this trip, and you've taught me to be more assertive, and she shuts him down and says, you know, what are you talking about? Like, you are a dad and a husband and a good person, and I'm a, like, delinquent asshole. Like, that's the lesson you learned, is that you need to be more like me. You know, like, that's a good, but it's that long. And then it's back to, like, a shitty car chase and a bunch of other dumb crap.
Fat jokes.
And, yeah, she gets hit by a car, like, literally the next scene. Literally the next scene gets hit by a car. So I hated it, and I'm probably in the minority, but it didn't do anything for me.
Fair enough. Rock Fist way down.
Way down. Yeah, my second of the year.
Yeah.
I think I think Gangster Squad's still worse.
Gangster Squad is horrible. That's
Gangster Squad. Like, I'm still thinking about how bad that movie is. Just at random times that'll cross my mind. Like when they have, I mean, I don't want to get up on a Gangster Squad tangent, but when the movie features a fist fight with Johnny Stompanato in front of fountains in Los Angeles. Wow. What balls. What balls to finish the movie with a cagey, shitty thing like that. It doesn't go that far. This movie doesn't go that far into just self-indulgent, dumb, audience-insulting bullshit. But it gets damn close. It gets really close.
All right.
All right, so now we've got...
Did you mean Mickey Cohen?
Mickey Cohen, sorry, Johnny Stompanato. I knew I was off, but I couldn't get that right. Anyway, that's how forgettable it is. I can't even remember who the crime guy was.
Yeah.
It doesn't even matter. I was thinking of a better movie that had Johnny Stompanato in it called L.A. Confidential.
Yeah.
So, All right, so now you got to tell me about Warm Bodies real quick.
Yeah,
and
so
then we can get out of here.
Well, Warm Bodies was it came out last week, and we didn't have a podcast last week, so this is kind of a cleanup review, and I'll make it quick. But I was pleasantly surprised, A, that this movie was as good as it was, and B, that it came in at number one at the box office last
week. Oh, it did.
Yeah, it made $20 million, dude. This is a big hit. This is Summit Entertainment. This is the company that does the Twilight films and recognize that property as being a cash cow. And when I first heard about the film, it was because I was getting flown to Montreal to interview the stars and be an extra on the set and have a set visit, which is the first one of those that I've ever done. So I was excited just because of the talent involved, which is Jonathan Levine, the writer-director, who's movie before this was 50-50, Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Seth Rogen, which I thought was a great movie. And John Malkovich, Teresa Palmer, Rob Corddry, and the lead actor, Nicholas Hoult, I'm not sure how to pronounce that. He's a British actor who was so good 10 years ago in About a Boy when he was really young. And obviously he's grown up now, and he recently was in the Colin Firth film, A Simple Man.
Yes.
God, I get that with that.
A Single Man and A Simple Man.
Yeah.
It's Single Man.
Single Man.
Yeah. Simple Man's the Coen Brothers movie.
I always get those confused.
I know.
And they came out in the same year, which is great. he was really good in that and also effective enough as Beast in X-Men First Class. But Warm Bodies is essentially taking a very a similar approach to Twilight in that it takes the analogy or the metaphor of teen alienation and is now dropping that into a zombie film. What it does differently from Twilight is that it doesn't take itself so goddamn seriously the whole time, which
do,
I think
do
is,
the zombies sparkle in this?
They don't sparkle, no. But I think it's key to this film's success that it has a sentient zombie in its main role, who, because he cannot speak out loud, because he is mainly able to communicate through grunts and things like that, because he's a zombie, we get his inner monologue, and that's in the form of some very witty and clever narration, self-effacing narration from Nicholas Hoult. And I think because of that, the film has a certain quality where it's constantly poking fun at itself. Now, the romance at its core, when the zombie bites Teresa Palmer's boyfriend and kills him and eats his brains, and those brains give him the memories of the boyfriend, he starts to fall in love with Teresa Palmer. That part of the film is not played for laughs. It's played very simply. And effectively, I think, because of the two actors, the chemistry that they have, that is a ridiculous relationship that's actually made fairly believable.
Yeah.
Now, the film is light on conflict. In the middle of the movie, it does kind of drag a little bit because there's not a lot of crazy plot things happening. He basically hides her out, and they kind of fall in love as much as they can. But this is a doomed romance because he's the kid on one side of the tracks because he's a zombie.
The zombie side.
She's on the other side of the tracks because her father, John Malkovich, is the leader of the humans that are trying to wipe out all the zombies.
Oh.
And she has to go back to her father and say, hey, they're not all that bad. Something might be happening. They might be, you know, overcoming their zombiness. And this is the first zombie movie I've ever seen that has hope. It's very strange because usually the zombie world establishes itself as a place with no hope, and we live within that.
Mm-hmm.
But this movie establishes quite early that there's a possibility that these zombies are getting better. And it's ridiculous.
Land of the Dead's a hopeful,
it
hopeful
does,
zombie.
Right. I mean, if we look at the Romero films, he's been kind of moving towards that.
Yeah.
Warm Bodies does it all in one film.
Yeah.
And again, it's a little bit much to take, but because I think of the sweetness of the main two actors and because of the self-aware narration and comedy, Rob Corddry is a big part of that as well, although I think he's underused. This movie works, and it works well, and it has a pop soundtrack that is used both ways as well. Sometimes it's used for irony and to make these situations more absurd. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's used to absolutely accentuate the emotion of a scene. But again, it's modern rock that does that. The ironic stuff is the stuff from the 80s.
Sure.
So I think Levine really has a firm grasp of his concept here. And he did a really good job fleshing out a movie that otherwise would have seemed even more thin. It's not a great film, but it was certainly refreshing. And I think the reason that it's connecting with a certain group right now is because it combines the ironic sense of humor with real emotion and heart. And so I'm giving it, I guess I didn't review it on the site, but I would give it a minor rock fist up.
Great. Yeah, there's a lot
maybe
of...
close to solid.
Close to solid, all right. Yeah. There's a lot of fertile ground to kind of till with superimposing a genre on top of High School. You know, because you get a lot of... it's free reign to do things with Isolation, Loneliness, things are changing, your life's changing, yep. You know, all that. And some of the best kind of genre movies I've seen in a long time do that. Chronicle was a great example of that.
Yeah.
You know, kind of put that teen angst into a manifestation.
I should
Amazing Spider-Man was a great example of that.
Yeah, these people are not in high school. I mean, there really isn't a high school anymore. I think they're even a little older than
that. Oh, so it's like post-apocalyptic?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So the zombies have been around for a while.
Yeah. Sorry, okay. I didn't make that clear. Yeah,
no.
It's a zombie. And that's one of the drawbacks, I guess, is that none of that is explained.
Oh, okay.
You know, but maybe it's not a drawback because we can accept that.
If you can figure it out from the context clues in the film, it's not a problem. But, no, I that makes total sense. You'd said the Twilight thing that had me thinking about that. But, you know, I want to see like a Les Mis superimposed onto like a high school. I think Les Mis in a high school
Sounds like the worst thing ever.
Should be the next thing that happens.
Because Les Mis essentially is a high school production.
Yeah, for sure. Well, in Tom Hooper's hands, it is.
The last thing I want to mention is just really obvious, but the zombie's name is R. He cannot remember the rest of his name. All he has is the first letter. Her name is Julie.
Mm-hmm. I get it.
There's a balcony scene. So, I mean, it's just kind of fun in that way. There's not a lot of Romeo and Juliet parallels beyond that.
Yeah.
And the main wrong side of the tracks thing. It's almost like, you know, the warring families or whatever.
Sure.
So, but that's just a nice little undercurrent. In the film, but it's a lot of fun, and it works, and it shouldn't. So,
well, apparently it works well enough to be number one. So
yeah, and it connected with an audience. I think honestly, I credit the marketing. I think they did a really good job of
it's been everywhere,
pushing the romantic comedy angle of it, and letting people know that it was going to be more fun and not so sullen like those Twilight movies.
Yeah. Ugh. All right. I'm glad those are gone. Well, that's it for this week. So if you can, it's out. See him more.
Yes.
Believe me. And Eric, please see him more. Warm Bodies sounds like it's worth checking out, too.
It's fun.
Identity Thief is not worth your time unless you hate everything I've ever reviewed and said, and then in which case, do the exact opposite of what I say and go see that right away. If you hate everything about me, you should go see Identity Thief.
There you go.
And, you know... It was a scattershot movie. It's not his best, and it's kind of disappointing that it's going to be what he goes out on. But there's still some good stuff in Side Effects. So if you like Soderbergh films, you're going to like this one. So check it out, too.
In the text for this podcast, will you write the quote, "If you hate everything about me, go see Identity Thief"?
Yeah, I would put it on the poster if I could.
Okay.
Might make a little stamp and just stamp them on the poster myself.
If you hate everything about Trevin McGee.
Right. You'll see this movie
go
twice.
See this film. Yeah.
All right. Well, have a good weekend, everybody. We'll see you next week.
Bye.